Hi, and welcome to number 14 of the History of Liberalism podcast. My name is Felix, and I hope you will enjoy what you're about to hear. But before we start, I must tell you that there are some construction work going on outside my window. I hope that won't mess up the sound quality of this episode too much. Thank you. As we spoke about in the last episode, the late 19th century were harsh years for liberals. Their ideas were shunned, even though their policies still enacted. That said, there was still hope. There were still people out there fighting the good fight. One of those guys were Herbert Spencer. He was born in Derby, England in 1820. His father served as the secretary of the Derby Philosophical Society, which had been founded by Erasmus Darwin, Charles Darwin's grandfather. A funny coincidence, since as we will see, Herbert Spencer is so closely associated with Charles Darwin. Spencer seems to have not gotten a lot of formal schooling, instead being taught by his father. He also seems to have had a hard time to find a calling. He tried his hand on several different jobs, worked as a civil engineer, and eventually found his calling working as a journalist. He also started to write books. His first book was published in 1851 and was called Social Statics. I don't think it was a hit, but Spencer was just starting out. Over the next 20 years, he would work tirelessly and eventually end up one of the most famous philosophers of his age. As I said, he was one of the greatest philosophers of his age, but Herbert Spencer's reputation is tainted. His name is closely associated to the idea of social Darwinism, which basically is Darwin's idea of the survival of the fittest applied to man and society. In some sense, this is a core idea of all liberals. Men are all different and choose different paths. Some are smart and choose smart paths, which leads them to acquire more wealth than those who choose less smart paths. Liberals see this as fair and just. And I guess you could call this the survival of the fittest. However, the problem begins when you take it too far and try to implement it as a state policy. If you think that only the wealthy or the fit should be allowed to have children, because then the children would be of a better breed, and then, I guess you can see where this is going. I can't say I can defend this position, so I'll leave it at that. And I'm not sure to what extent Spencer deserves to have his name soiled by social Darwinism. Maybe the fact that he, and not Darwin, coined the term survival of the fittest had something to do with it. But then again, that's not what I brought him up. He had a lot of, if you allow the expression, normal liberal ideas, and it's those we will take a closer look at now. Spencer is quite hard to pin down with regards to politics. In his early years, he was quite a radical liberal. Social Statics, the book he published in his early 30s, had a distinctive libertarian streak. Murray Rothbard, a guy we will come back to in a later episode of this podcast, once called Social Statics the greatest single work of libertarian political philosophy ever written. In it, Spencer argues that the state will soon be obsolete and wither away. He also stated that the state was something that you should be able to opt out of. He also had some other quite radical ideas at this time, like universal suffrage, but not only for women, but for kids too. That last part you don't usually hear, do you? Spencer is probably best described as a utilitarianist. Had a lot in common with John Stuart Mill. For example, both believed that the state should leave the people alone to the largest possible extent, as people know best how to make themselves happy. But over time, Spencer turned more conservative. I guess you could say that he eventually turned into a grumpy old man with little love for anything or anyone. That did not stop him from getting supporters. One of those were William Graham Sumner. Sumner was an American. Born in 1840, he grew up in a small community called Hartford, and when he left, he did it in order to go to jail. Sumner did not fight in the war. No, he paid his way out of that one. And instead, he went to Europe to study some more. It is said that he mastered Hebrew, Greek, Latin, French, German, Dutch, Spanish, Portuguese, Polish, Danish, Swedish, Russian, and Italian. To me, this sounds like someone making a good story better. But anyways. He stayed in Europe for several years, first in Geneva, then in Göttingen, and eventually in Oxford. He then went back to Yale, where he spent the remainder of his career, holding the first professorship of sociology not only at Yale, but in the whole of the United States. His health took a turn for the worse in 1890, but despite that he could trudge on for another 20 years. In 1909 he retired, but he probably shouldn't have done that, as he suffered several strokes and died in May of 1910. Sumner was a staunch supporter of classical liberalism. He was also just a staunch opponent of socialism. He was heavily engaged in the anti-imperialist movement, particularly upset about the United States' endeavors in the Philippines. Many associated Sumner with social Darwinism, and I'm not the one to judge, but as far as I can tell, he was, at least to some extent, a man who adhered to the idea of the survival of the fittest. I guess his line of reasoning went that in the end, life is a fight, and if no one intervenes, the fittest will win this fight. Thus, all interference does is help produce and promote the unfit. I guess that's one way of tackling the concept of survival of the fittest. We must now hop back across the pond and meet another man who was inspired by good old Herbert Spencer, called Oberon Herbert. Herbert was a noble, and mind you, in 1838, when Herbert was born, those things still mattered. He was the third son of the third Earl of Carnarvon. He spent a couple of years as an officer in the army before going to Oxford to study. After his graduation, he stayed in Oxford as a teacher. However, he seems to have had a hard time to let go of his old military life, as during the 1860s he traveled to Denmark to witness the Prussian-Danish War, to the United States to experience the Civil War, and to France to get a closer look at the Franco-Prussian War. He also managed to be in Paris during the Paris Commune. Then in 1870, he managed to get enough votes to go to Parliament, where he spent 4 years. Herbert isn't one of the John Locke or Immanuel Kant kind of guys. He isn't famous, so I'm not quite sure what he did once he left Parliament. Rumor has it he became a farmer and then he died in 1906. Well, I guess that's life. He's in this podcast because he is the father of voluntarianism, a small ism, sure, but an interesting one. The idea is that the government should have only two objectives, to defend self-ownership and individual rights. And it must never initiate force in order to do this. So then one asks, isn't taxation force, at least in the sense that if you don't pay your taxes, you will go to jail? Sure, Herbert would have answered. Taxes are force used by the government. The solution? Paying your taxes optional. His line of reasoning was that self-ownership made force an abomination. It didn't matter that a majority was behind the decision to tax the subjects of a state. About that, he said, if we are self-owners, neither an individual, nor a majority, nor a government can have rights of ownership in other men. So how would this work? Basically, it would be an opt-in state. Those who paid would get the services provided by the state, and those who didn't wouldn't. I guess he realized that this would be kind of messy when it came to social services and the likes. So he stated that the government's only role would be to defend its subjects' life and property. Anyway, social services other than that weren't really provided by any government in the late 19th century. It's an interesting idea, this opt-in state, and it would severely undermine the role of the state, which I guess was the whole point. And this brings us close to the guys who wanted to abolish the state altogether, the anarchists. The guys we've been talking about in this episode were no big fans of the government. And you know who were even bigger anti-fans of the government? That's right, the anarchists. And to some extent, liberalism and anarchism blends together. So I figured we should spend a couple of minutes discussing anarchism, what it is, where it came from, and what it has in common with liberalism. And yes, where it differs. Well, the first modern anarchist, even though himself never used that term, was William Godwin. Born in Britain, he rose in prominence, at least to some extent, during the French Revolution. In hindsight, probably one of the most interesting thing about Godwin was that he was married to Mary Wollstonecraft, an early, if not the first, champion of women's rights. They had a daughter, also called Mary Wollstonecraft, who would grow up to become a writer and whose most famous work was Frankenstein. Anyways, I'm getting off track now. Well, his basic political idea seems to have been that the government, no matter the type, was bad for man, and it was basically unnecessary. When the people got more educated, the need for the state would wither away. That said, he did not believe in the revolution, as in that the government should be toppled by force. Anyways, anarchism became a force to be reckoned with through Mikhail Bakunin, born in the early 19th century in a noble Russian family of modest means. He at first pursued a career in the military. After a while, everyone involved realized that Bakunin did not have the knack for military life, so he quit his job and traveled to Moscow to study philosophy. Somehow that failed and he wound up in Berlin, where he did actually study philosophy, and quite quickly were drawn to the young Hegelians. You remember the left-leaning group Marx had associated himself with? I'm not even going to try to cover the rest of Bakunin's life. In short, he lived the life of a vagabond, stirring up trouble pretty much everywhere he went. The form of anarchism Bakunin advocated wanted to abolish the state, but not only the state, also the private ownership of the means of production. And that pretty much sums up anarchism. To be fair, did not all want to abolish the private ownership of the means of production, but they want to abolish the state. That's the main difference between liberalism and anarchism. A liberal do not want to abolish the state, but he or she wants the state to be small and the responsibilities of the state to be limited. As you probably understand, there's quite a difference here. Another big difference, as far as I understand it, is that liberals never advocated revolution. Sure, they wanted to change society, but to my knowledge, they have never sought revolution. They might have said that there are situations where revolutions might be justifiable, like Locke did, but they always seem to have framed it not so much as a revolution, but as a defense of the state when the ruler of the state has gone off the tracks. In short, they have always tried to work within the existing system. The same cannot be said for the anarchists. I'm gonna continue this discussion for a bit, even though I probably should stop. We haven't discussed libertarianism yet, and we sure haven't discussed libertarianism's even more extreme cousin, anarcho-capitalism. But to make it super easy, libertarianism is basically just what we up until this point have called liberalism. It's just a new label. They want to keep the state, if for nothing else, for the state to run the police and the judicial system. An anarcho-capitalist says screw it and want to abolish the state completely, even the part that runs the police and the judicial system. Which sounds pretty much like anarchism, doesn't it? And I guess it is. But as I understand it, the difference lies in what the anarcho-capitalist imagines as happening next. They do not want to abolish the state, rather they do not want to abolish the basic functions performed by the state in a libertarian society. What I'm trying to say is that an anarcho-capitalist wants a judicial system and they want it to function the same way as in a libertarian society. They just want to pay for it in another way. They do not want it to be paid for by taxes, but by some other means. I guess what they are saying is that safety and the rule of law mustn't be provided by the state and financed by taxes. I guess they're saying that it could just as easily be provided by a private organization and paid for in cold, hard cash, just like any other service. Well, that's my two cents about anarchism, libertarianism, and anarcho-capitalism. We're actually nearing the end of this episode, but before we go, I will spend a couple of minutes talking about the beginning of the 20th century. As you all know, the 20th century was a pretty busy century, and I'm gonna try to cover like the first 30 years of the century. I want to bring up three things that happened during this time that had severe implications on the world, but also on philosophy and the stuff we're going to be talking about for the next couple of episodes. So the first thing that happened was the First World War. The war in itself was to some extent an accident. Princip shot the Austrian Archduke and the game was on. I guess that there were several reasons for this. The most hands-on explanation were all the mutual agreements between European countries to defend one another in case of war. On one hand, a good idea, as it severely lowered the chances for war. On the other hand, a really, really bad idea, since it guaranteed a huge frigging war if that unlikely war actually became real. So when the Archduke was shot, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia, so Russia mobilized, which threatened Germany enough, so they declared war on Russia. And then the genie was out of the bottle, so Germany declared war on France, and since the UK got this pact with France, they declared war on Germany. And you see, in a matter of weeks, pretty much all of Europe was at war. To some extent, it was a surprise. I know that Ludwig von Wittgenstein, the Austrian philosopher who did not dabble enough with politics to be brought up in this podcast, resided in England at this time. But as it was summer, he was going home to Vienna. But before he left, he made plans with an English buddy to meet in France for a joint holiday by the Mediterranean a few weeks later. And then the war came. Instead of a nice holiday, they spent years in opposing trenches. So in one sense, it was a surprise. But in another sense, this was a war bound to happen. The arms race had been on for years. Plans had been made, just in case. So hadn't Princip shot the Archduke, well then chances are some other incident would have caused the war. But what do I know? From every imaginable viewpoint, the war was horrible. And this is true not least from a liberal point of view. The Treaty of Versailles was a harsh treaty, and the open world that had been was but a memory. The world was set on a path to financial crisis, and we'll get back to this crisis. But before that, I want to bring up the second thing that happened, and that was the Russian Revolution. In 1917, the people, or at least the communists, rose up in Russia and toppled the Tsar. Lenin took power and established a socialist state. The Soviet Union rose and would stand for more than 70 years. 70 years the Soviet Union would use wisely if one wants to be remembered as one of the worst regimes of all time. The establishment of the Soviet Union had several key implications on our story. First off, the empire that sprawled from Moscow would become a formidable enemy of the democratic West, and something every thinker had to adjust to. Also, since the true crimes committed by the Soviets and the suffering the people had to endure in order for the state to keep projecting success, well, the Soviet Union up until the fall was generally viewed as a success and as a proof that there was another way besides the free market economy. Well, the last thing that happened that I want to bring up in this episode is the event that started on October 24th, 1929, or as it's known in hindsight, Black Tuesday. In a single day, Dow Jones fell by 11%, and just like that, the Roaring Twenties screeched to a halt. Had it stopped at that, things might not have turned out too bad. But it didn't stop at that. What followed was 10 years of global depression. Everywhere unemployment and suffering ruled. One of the worst hit countries were Germany, where the Nazi Party increased their share of the vote from 2.6% in 1928 to 18.3% in 1930. All in all, the liberal world characterized by free markets and free trade looked pretty bad. In the short term, this didn't really matter. People were too consumed by the depression. And then the Second World War began. But when the war was over and things started to return to normal, no one had forgotten that the root of all evil was spelled free markets and maybe liberals. As you probably understand, the early 20th century was not a good time to be a liberal. Liberalism as an ideology was pretty much dead, and it wouldn't get back to life. I mean, I don't know when, but it took a long time. And liberalism as an ideology did not evolve much during these years. These were like survival years. But what did evolve during the first half of the 20th century was economics. So in the next episode, we will take a closer look at the Austrian school. Pretty much, we're going to talk about two guys, one called Ludwig von Mises and the other one Friedrich Hayek. Okay, so I just want to finish by saying that you can find this podcast homepage at historyofliberalism.wordpress.com. You can send me an email at historyofliberalismpodcast@gmail.com, or you can find me on Twitter at H of Liberalism. Well, thank you for listening, and until next time, have a good time. Bye.